TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Crazy weather and the Arctic meltdown. How are they connected? Professor Jennifer Francis. Each year in the last 3 decades, scientists have paid attention to the status of the ice at the end of the Arctic summer. In past years, observations from satellites and submarines have shown decreasing ice thickness and area covered for the months from June to September. That has led to an ongoing debate whether and when the Arctic might be ice-free in September. But scientists are not the only interested parties. There's growing evidence of the connection between Arctic melting and weather events in the Northern Hemisphere. Droughts, colds, heat waves, as well as flooding. Dr. Jennifer Francis is research professor at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her interests are the connections between the rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, and impacts of Arctic sea ice loss on accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. Dr. Jennifer Francis has a Bachelor of Science in Meteorology and a PhD in Atmospheric Sciences from the University of Washington in 1994. After coming to Rutgers, she founded and co-directed their Climate and Environmental Change Initiative. She also has direct personal experience with climate and weather, as she and her husband circumnavigated the world in a sailboat between 1980 and 1985. Jennifer Francis spoke at the New England Aquarium in the fall 2017 lecture season. Professor Jennifer Francis.
I'm sure you're all well aware that Mother Nature has just gone berserk in the last few years. We've seen all kinds of extreme weather events transpiring all over the Northern Hemisphere. All those examples all had something in common. These are all the types of extreme events that have to do with weather patterns that have become persistent. They've become stuck. So when I talk about extreme events from now on, as they're connected to the Arctic, I'm talking about the kind of extreme events that are related to very persistent weather patterns. So for example, if it's dry for a week or two, no big deal. But if it goes on for months or even years, it can turn into a pretty significant drought. So that's the idea. All right, so I want to step back first and kind of set the stage a little bit here. I'm sure most of you here are very aware of the fact that our climate is changing. Well, you've probably heard from some people that are a little bit skeptical of what's going on right now that the climate has always changed and this is just a natural cycle. Well, let's take a look at that. Here we are looking at two graphs, two curves here. The red is what the Earth's temperature has been doing over the last 400,000 years or so. You can clearly see that it's been up and down over that time period. And those ups and downs in temperature, we understand very well what caused those. It's because of shifts in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And they're very regular. When the temperature's warm back then, that's when we had what we call an interglacial period, when the Earth was warm. And when it gets colder, and you'll notice it's only several degrees that separates those, that was an ice age. So the Earth has fluctuated back and forth between these warm periods and ice ages. Along with that, the blue curve there is showing you how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere at the same time. And you'll see that they're very closely related to each other. Until you get to the present time, here we are with over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now. You can see it's nothing like it's been in approximately 500,000 years. We are completely off the chart. And we know exactly where that carbon dioxide came from. It came from mostly burning fossil fuels. What you may also notice is that the temperature hasn't caught up with that carbon dioxide yet. There's a big lag in the system. We put that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere so fast that the Earth has not had time to catch up to being in equilibrium with that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But one thing we do know is the last time we saw carbon dioxide levels this high, which was many millions of years ago, we know that the globe was several degrees warmer than it is now, and we know that sea levels were tens of feet higher. So this is where we're going. So I'm guessing that most of you know what greenhouse gases are and why we care about them, but let's just quickly review. Why do we care about this carbon dioxide so much? Well, here we have a little schematic of how the Earth's climate system works. We have the sun up there in the sky, roughly 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and we know that hot things like stars and our sun emit energy at very short wavelengths. This is the light we can see with our eyes. That very short wavelength energy penetrates right through our atmosphere, except for when it hits a cloud. Most of it makes it to the surface, and it warms the surface of the Earth. The Earth, on the other hand, is more like 60 degrees on average. And warm things also emit energy, but at much longer wavelengths. Okay, we call it infrared radiation or long wave radiation. And it just so happens that long wave radiation is absorbed by greenhouse gases. So what happens? The Earth emits this long wave energy, it's trapped by the greenhouse gases and emitted back down to the Earth. It's just like putting a blanket on the Earth, and they're there naturally. But when we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas, it's just like putting an extra blanket on your bed. It traps more heat down by the surface. So by adding so much carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, we're trapping a lot more of that heat that the Earth is emitting. All right, I said that the temperature of the Earth hasn't caught up yet to the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, but it's trying to. Over the last 17 years, we've had 16 of the warmest years on record. Let's get to the Arctic now. You might remember that the Paris Accord was aiming for 2 degrees of global warming. Well, here we are bumping up against 1.5 already in 2016. So we're getting very close to that limit that we're trying not to reach, getting awfully close. All right, but then when we go to look at the Arctic, things look very different. Here's what those same years look like in terms of the anomalies of the temperature of the Arctic. So how different those temperatures are from what they should be over these few years. Notice the scale. 1.5 is way down at the bottom. We're up here in the 6, 7, 8 degrees centigrade above normal in the Arctic. The Arctic is warming much, much faster than anywhere else on the globe. And if we look at it spatially, here we are looking down on the North Pole. You can see the USA on the left and Asia on the right. And what you notice, the warming over the Arctic is much, much larger than it is anywhere else. And you see this very interesting pattern of cooling happening in the eastern US. Think some of our most recent winters around here. They've been quite cold. Look over at Asia, much colder than normal. What the heck's going on there? That's what we're going to get to the bottom of tonight. All right, how do we know that humans are responsible for this extra warming that we're seeing? Well, we have a lot of ways to figure that question out, but probably the most useful way, the most, I think, compelling way, is that we have these very good computer models, computer simulations. They're basically just a whole bunch of equations that simulate all the processes that happen in the real climate system. They make rain, they make snow, they make currents in the ocean, they make winds, they make storms, and we can use these climate models to try to look back in time and look forward in time and simulate how the Earth's climate should behave. If we do that with one of these models and we simulate what the Earth's temperature was going back in time, but we only tell the model about some of the natural changes that have happened, things like volcanoes that have erupted or changes in the solar output, things like that. So going back to, say, 1900 there, we see that the blue line is what the model is saying happened in the past, and the black line is what the real world actually did. So you can see that the model and the real world match up pretty darn well. So we have pretty good confidence in these models. However, if we continue on to near present, we get this split. The model actually thinks the Earth should be getting cooler. That's because the sun is actually getting a little weaker. And the real world is warming. So why the split? Because we didn't tell the model that carbon dioxide was increasing in the atmosphere. And if we do that, and we compare the model now in red to the real world in black, we see that there's a very good match. So this is one of the ways that we can know for sure that because we're increasing greenhouse gases, we're getting this extra warming happening in the atmosphere. So, and it's not just the temperature that's changing, we're also seeing the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere increase. Over the last, well, going back to the 1970s, we've seen about a 7% increase in the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. Why would you care about water vapor? We should care a lot, because water vapor is one of the main things that fuels storms. We have more water vapor in the atmosphere. When that water vapor condenses, it releases heat, and it provides energy for storms. Of course, it also makes more rain. And what we're seeing is that over the last several decades, compared to the beginning of the century, we see that the frequency of heavy downpours and heavy precipitation events has increased dramatically, especially in the Northeast here where we live. 71% increase since, say, the 1950s or so. It's a big, big change. All right, so let's start talking more about the Arctic. Another symptom of climate change, as you, I'm sure, have heard, is that the amount of ice in the Arctic is disappearing. In particular, the sea ice. The sea ice is floating on the Arctic Ocean. Just to remind you, the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by land, whereas Antarctica is a continent with a big, huge pile of ice on top, surrounded by ocean. Two very different places. So the Arctic sea ice, we can go back and look at the last 1,500 years or so and get a pretty good idea of how much sea ice there was floating on the Arctic Ocean. How do we do that? We look at sediments in the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, and depending on what kind of critters are living in that mud, we can know whether there was light available or not, ice there or not. That's how we can reconstruct roughly how much sea ice there was. So if we do that, we see that going back about 1,500 years or so, the amount of sea ice floating on the Arctic Ocean, and this is the real estate covered by that sea ice, hasn't changed too much. It wiggles up and down a bit, but it stayed pretty steady. Until we get to about 1960 or 70, somewhere in there. And here we see a big, big change, along with that very rapid warming that's happening in the Arctic. Big decline in the amount of sea ice. We are in uncharted territory. 2012 was the lowest amount of sea ice we've ever had in the summertime in the Arctic. That's the standing record right now. But the last few years have been very, very close to that. 2017 came in at about number 6. We're in this regime now of much, much less sea ice in terms of its aerial extent, its real estate that it covers. We've lost half in 30 years. If you take into account the thickness and you calculate the volume of that ice, we've lost 3/4 of the sea ice floating in the Arctic Ocean in only 30 years. This is just a huge change. So the question is, geographically speaking, why is the Arctic warming up so fast and not somewhere else? The reason the Arctic is warming so fast, one of the reasons, there's actually a whole bunch of reasons, but the easiest one to explain and the simplest one to understand is that when we lose all this ice that's floating on the Arctic Ocean, that ice is very bright. So when the sun's energy hits it, most of it goes right back to outer space. It never enters the climate system. It never warms anything. If we lose a bunch of that ice because of the globe warming, because of greenhouse gases, then we shrink that ice. That means that's what's left there, where the ice used to be, is ocean, and it's very dark. So that ocean absorbs all that sunshine instead, warms up the water and melts even more ice, which reflects even less of the sun's energy, which absorbs even more into the ocean, which melts even more ice. And this is something we call a positive feedback. This is the main reason. There's several other positive feedbacks that happen in the Arctic as well, but that's the main one, and it's the easiest one to explain. So, why do we care about this Arctic warming so fast? So I want you to think about a layer of air. This layer of air extends from Boston all the way up to the Arctic, all right? So we know that air expands when it warms, right? We know that it's warmer here than it is in the Arctic. So that layer of air is thicker here than it is in the Arctic. So imagine yourself sitting on top of this layer, looking towards the north. It would look like you were looking down a hill. Well, that's exactly what the air thinks too. It feels that pull downhill, just like water flowing down a mountain, and it creates a wind blowing towards the north. It's flowing down that hill in the atmosphere. But because the Earth is spinning, everything in the northern hemisphere gets turned to the right. That wind also gets turned to the right, and it becomes what we call the jet stream. And the jet stream is this ribbon of fast-moving wind high over our heads, up where the jets fly. Okay? Now, think back to Arctic amplification. The rapidly warming Arctic, what's happening? It's warming faster in the Arctic. So the thickness of that layer is growing faster up there than it is here. It's making that hill less steep. So there's less force driving that wind towards the north. We're weakening the winds of the jet stream. And when the jet stream gets weaker, it tends to take a wavier path as it travels around the northern hemisphere. It's more easily deflected from its path by things like mountains and different temperatures over the ocean and things like that. So anything that's when the winds are weaker, they're more easily deflected. And so we see these bigger north-south swings in the jet stream. So why do you care about that? Well, there are actually two effects that we need to take into account here. The first one I just told you about, where the winds are actually getting weaker. This is something we can measure. It is happening now, and we expect it to get even more so in the future. The other thing that we see happening is that those northward swings, which we call ridges, are getting longer. They're extending farther towards the north. And both of these things are important because it's causing this waviness to increase in the jet stream. So why do we care about these waves anyway in the jet stream? Well, it turns out they create our weather. So here's a typical wave in the jet stream over the United States. We see this big ridge, a northward swing over California, a dip over where we live. And the first thing you notice is that the jet stream there separates the cold air that's to the north of it from the warm air that's to the south of it. So if the jet stream is, in this case, it's just north of us, we'd be in the warm part. So we'd have warmer than normal air, all right? But the other thing is this wave in the jet stream is actually what creates the high pressures, the low pressures, the blue skies, and the storms that we experience. So in the part of the jet stream over the west in this schematic, where the winds are coming out of the northwest, is where we get nice clear sky, dry, no storms. That's been the case over California for much of the last few years, leading to their drought there. And us, over on the other side here, we've tended to be, especially in the winter, in the stormy part of the jet stream. So when the winds are coming from the southwest, bringing a lot of heat and moisture up from the Gulf of Mexico, when the pattern is like this, that's when we tend to get our nor'easters. But the point is, when these waves are really large like this, they tend to stick around a long time. This is the idea, okay? The Arctic is warming really fast, and we think it's causing these waves to get bigger, which means that they're causing our weather patterns to become more persistent. This is the basic idea. If you don't remember anything else from tonight, that's what you should remember. Okay, I'm going to end with talking a little bit about hurricanes, because they've been in the news so much this year, and a lot of people have been wondering, whether there's any connection between these really bizarre hurricanes we've had this year and climate change, and maybe even an Arctic connection. Well, I'm here to tell you there's absolutely no doubt about it. There is a connection. We've seen more intense storms, we've seen more rapidly developing storms, and we've seen storms taking some very odd paths, all right? A fact, as we've already talked about, we've lost a lot of sea ice, we've also lost a lot of snow in the spring over high latitude land areas. Both of these things together are darkening the Earth. We're absorbing a lot more of the sun's energy than we used to because of both of these things. Those are both Arctic things. And as a result, we're putting more heat into the atmosphere. We're putting more heat into the oceans. Heat is energy. Heat and energy are what hurricanes need to form. We're warming those oceans, we're warming the air, and we're also increasing the evaporation from the oceans into the air. And remember I said in the beginning how water vapor is increasing and how that water vapor is fuel for storms? Well, both of these things are fuel for storms. So these are adding to the strength of hurricanes. As I mentioned earlier when I talked about how the moisture had increased in the global atmosphere by about 7% or so, that extra moisture actually, when it evaporates from the ocean and goes into the atmosphere and then it condenses into clouds, goes from the vapor phase to the liquid phase, it releases heat into the air. So it warms the atmosphere. And that provides even more heat for hurricanes to feed off of. It releases its energy. And not to mention the fact that it produces a lot of rain. Okay? Another fact. The loss of land ice. So this is the ice that's sitting on top of Greenland, for example, or glaciers. That ice is sitting up on the land. So when that ice melts, it goes right into the ocean and it adds to the volume of the ocean. Right now, it's accounting for about half of the sea level rise that we've already observed. When I say half of sea level rise, I'm talking about we're measuring sea level rise increasing at some rate. Half of it is because of the melting ice. The other half is because the oceans are expanding because they're warming. Just like air expands when it warms, so does water. So that's the two halves of the total observed sea level rise. So that's another way that tropical storms, and all storms for that matter, are doing more damage. We've got a higher ocean now, the storm surges are higher than they used to be, and any storm waves are riding on a higher ocean. So these are two ways that the warming in the Arctic is helping to make hurricanes both more intense and also do more damage. What's less certain is how the Arctic might be affecting the winds that steer hurricanes. This is a topic of research, whether we're seeing these disrupted wind patterns changing the steering currents of storms. And what come to mind are Harvey and Sandy. Remember with Harvey, it came very slowly out of the Gulf of Mexico and basically parked over Houston and dumped 50 inches of rain. I mean, that's a lot of snow, but rain? It's unbelievable. And you'll remember Sandy took that crazy left-hand turn and went into New Jersey, affected us as well. There is evidence that what's happening in the summer, especially the loss of snow on high-latitude land areas, is pushing the jet stream northward. And that is leaving storms like Harvey without any wind to push them, and that's why Harvey was so stationary. I can't say that the Arctic caused Harvey to be that way, but we expect to see that kind of behavior to happen more often in the future. Okay, just to wrap this up, how about 2016? 2016 was a crazy year. I already showed you that it was much warmer than any other year, but it also turns out it had a lot of extreme events. And we can look at what was happening in the Arctic when a lot of those extreme events came along. So this is a look back at the whole year of 2016, what was going on in the Arctic. The blobs of heat going all the way up into the atmosphere over the Arctic and how they evolved over that whole year. Where it's red, it's when the Arctic had an episode of heating, not just down by the surface, but all the way up through the stratosphere. it kind of comes in pulses. It's not kind of a gradual thing. And if we look at these pulses of heat and we line them up with all kinds of extreme events that happened that year, what we notice is that when we get these big pulses of heat in the Arctic, we see floods, we see snowstorms, we see cold events, we see melting events on Greenland, we see heat waves, depending on what time of year you're looking at, all sorts of extreme events. And it's not to say that extreme events can't happen other times, but there is a definite alignment of when we get these big pulses in the Arctic and these extreme events. All right, so what about the future? What are we talking about here? And what can we do about it? Well, we can use those computer models that I described in the beginning to get a handle on what might happen in the future. So here we are in the gray, looking back in time with computer models, and then from about 2005 onward is a computer simulation of the future. The black line on there is what the real world has done in terms of how much sea ice there is floating on the Arctic Ocean. So we've seen, as I showed you in the beginning, the amount of sea ice is decreasing over time. The models are able to capture that. Maybe the real world is losing ice a little faster even than the models project. But we have these different outcomes for the future, depending on what we do with emissions of carbon dioxide, getting back to the very beginning of what I talked about. So there's the real world, what's been going on. Here's what we expect to happen according to the models if we keep going the way we're going, with emitting about the same amount of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're going to lose all of the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean in the summer by about the middle of the century. Pretty much all the models agree with that. But if we can reduce our emissions a lot, we'd have to almost stop emitting carbon dioxide to get this to become a solution that is one that we would like to see. But it's possible. It's possible that we can preserve that sea ice in the Arctic and give our children and grandchildren a future that isn't quite as difficult as it looks like that we're headed for now. So with that, thank you so much for being here tonight.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University, Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her interests are the connections between rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, particularly extreme weather events, causes and impacts of Arctic sea ice loss, and the linkages to accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. She spoke at the New England Aquarium in the fall lecture season on October 19, 2017. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.